Airlines Confidential with Ben Baldanza and Scott McCartney is made possible with support from Pratt & Whitney, committed to working smarter, cleaner, and greener today for a more sustainable tomorrow. Learn more at PrattWhitney.com. DoHop, revolutionizing travel connectivity. Learn how to unlock unlimited connections simply at DoHop.com. And Cirium, the world's most trusted source of aviation analytics. Visit Cirium.com. We also welcome your business's support. Info at airlinesconfidential.com.
Welcome to Airlines Confidential. I'm Scott McCartney. Really, I am. This is Scott-300, the conventional voice option. Regular listeners commended you, Ben Baldanza, for your new voice option, and some took the opportunity to point out how drab my voice now sounds by comparison. I proudly wear the classic label, Ben. Congratulations to you for the fantastic launch of Ben NVO.
Thanks, Scott, and thanks to everyone who responded to my new voice. It was great to hear that listeners approve. We'll keep going with it. I think we can even tweak the AI software that takes the library of my voice and puts it to whatever I type. I'm so glad longtime friends and listeners recognize that the AI voice does sound very much like my regular voice. Speaking of familiar voices, we'll talk to Rudy Maxa, the savvy traveler, who is familiar to many as one of the best-known consumer travel experts on television and radio. Rudy is a former Washington Post investigative reporter who has been a trusted source of travel information for the public for decades. We'll talk to him about trends, troubles, what he'd change if he were running an airline, and how AI is going to impact travel beyond making Airlines Confidential easier to listen to.
Rudy's a good friend, and I've been a guest on his radio show many times. I think it'll be fun to turn the tables a bit. Lots of news this week. And none of it is good as Ben NVO. I want to start with something that isn't really official yet, but seems certain, and I've been meaning to bring it up. United Airlines is now the biggest airline in the world. If you look at passenger traffic in 2023, United was number one, Delta was number two, and American, which used to be the biggest, has dropped to number three. Just by a hair, Delta and American had almost the same number of revenue passenger miles. Airline size isn't measured by passengers. It's measured by how many passengers you carry and how far you take them. Revenue passenger miles is that measure. One RPM is one passenger carried 1 mile, or RPK if you're looking at kilometers. So congratulations to United. The official rankings will come as numbers get tallied around the world, but the biggest in the U.S. is still the biggest in the world, and that's now United. Since I was looking up stuff, I also took note of which of the big three was most profitable last year. Not a surprise to people who know the business, but Delta was by far the most profitable big airline. Delta's net profit margin in 2023 was 7.9%, quite respectable in the business world. United was number two at 4.9%, and American was the laggard of the big three at 1.6%. Southwest, if you look at the big four, had a tough year coming off the operational problems, but still was more profitable than American with a net profit margin of 1.9%. It's interesting to remember what a big difference there is among the big airlines right now and how small the profit margins are in this business for most of them. For comparison, I check Kroger. Grocery stores are notoriously low margin, right? Yes. Kroger's net profit margin last year was 1.4%, even less than American. General Motors was 5.9%. Amazon was 6.3%. Hertz, 6.6%. FedEx, 7%. Marriott, 13%. And Apple, boy, it's a different world in tech. Apple's net profit margin was 25.3%. If I was going to start an airline, I'd call it Apple. People might think it was cool and pay a big premium for that.
thanks for pulling all these data. I'm not surprised that Delta is number one in margin. Their business model is more finely tuned than others. I'm also not surprised that United is number one in size. This has been a goal of CEO Scott Kirby for a while. They've done this by adding more long-haul international flying and by replacing regional jets with full-size jets domestically. Hat trick that I'm also not surprised that American is the laggard among the big three on size and margin. They have the smallest international network, and their hubs all tend to focus on shorter flights. Since I was at U.S. Airways, Charlotte has been all about Florida, for example. On margin, they seem mystified about how to make money outside of their loyalty program.
It's very interesting. There is a lot of U.S. Airways and American, isn't there, Ben? So speaking of smaller profits at Southwest, last week we learned that Southwest Airlines now expects delivery of only 46 new 737 MAX airplanes from Boeing, down from 79. That shortfall includes six fewer 737 MAX 8s and all 27 MAX 7s that Southwest was scheduled to receive this year. The airline said the reduction in deliveries has left its capacity forecast for the year in flux, but flights will certainly have to be cut from the schedule since capacity will most certainly be down. Southwest is slowing pilot and flight attendant hiring. The airline said it didn't know yet how this would impact its financials, but Wall Street assumed the worst. Southwest shares tumbled almost 20% last week. Southwest CEO Bob Jordan said simply, and obviously, Boeing needs to be a better company. Right. Southwest is hardly alone in its Boeing woes. Alaska Airlines and Ryanair, both of which fly 737-only fleets just like Southwest, both have said they will trim schedules this year. United said it was pausing pilot hiring, and it urged Boeing to give up on getting the MAX 10 certified and instead focus on building more MAX 9s, which is already certified and in service.
Boeing has had a rough few weeks to add to their rough few years. Looking worldwide, airlines everywhere are affected by this. With Southwest flying only variants of the 737, it's not surprising they are impacted heavily by this. When you combine Boeing's issues with the PNWG TF delivery shortfalls, air traffic controller shortages plus pilot shortages all suggest the industry needs a catch-up year. This could breathe more life into the LCCs since less capacity always means higher fares. There's more Boeing news, a lot more. A Boeing 787 Dreamliner flying from Sydney, Australia to Auckland, New Zealand for LATAM had a sudden and severe plunge that tossed people into the ceiling and resulted in 50 passengers needing medical treatment. There was instant concern about another Boeing malfunction, especially after one of the passengers reportedly claimed one of the pilots told him that all the screens in the cockpit went black. That might suggest some kind of power problem, but our friend John Ostrower of the Air Current reported a few days ago that investigators are looking into a low-tech possible cause, whether one of the pilot seats moved and a pilot bumped into the yoke.
And after that, the Wall Street Journal reported that Boeing sent an advisory to airlines to check the cover on a switch on the back of the pilot's seat. The Journal reported that investigators think a flight attendant serving the pilot a meal may have hit a switch that moves the motorized seat forward, pushing the pilot into the yoke of the plane and causing the terrible sudden plunge. The switch isn't supposed to be used when a pilot is in the seat, and it is supposed to be protected by a plastic cover. Apparently, a loose cover could jam the rocker switch and move the seat all the way forward. With no confidence in Boeing, every incident is going to get maximum scrutiny, as it should. We'll watch this one closely. Continuing with Boeing news, the National Transportation Safety Board told Congress that investigators were not getting the documentation they need from Boeing covering the work done on the Alaska Airlines MAX 9 that had the door plug fly off. We know that the door plug was removed from the plane last September at the factory when Boeing was making rivet repairs to the fuselage before delivery to Alaska. Anytime anything is done on an airplane, there's paperwork. And now Boeing is telling the NTSB that it is unable to find this paperwork. Further, the NTSB asked for the security camera footage of the factory floor at the time that the work was done on that plane. Boeing says the footage was, quote, overwritten. This is a big deal. We don't know if someone at Boeing took the paperwork and destroyed the video, or if the company is just incompetent in its record keeping. And we don't know if someone might have been motivated to destroy records because the Justice Department has made it known that it has opened a criminal investigation. Willie Walsh, the head of the International Air Transport Association, reminded us that criminal prosecution and aviation mistakes can be detrimental to safety. Everyone involved needs to be open and honest because that's how we learn and improve and fix problems. Saving lives is more important. I agree with that, Ben. However, destroying documents is another thing altogether. That's contrary to making safety a priority, and I have no problem prosecuting anyone in aviation for destroying documents or trying to cover up problems. Remember, a Boeing test pilot went on trial for deceiving the FAA after the MAX crashes and was acquitted by a jury. Boeing paid a huge fine to the government in exchange for immunity from prosecution for the company and top executives. So Boeing employees were probably worried about criminal prosecution from the start of this door plug almost disaster, and I think you could easily see someone involved trying to get rid of incriminating evidence. Forgetting to reinstall the bolts on the door plug is one problem, not a crime unless it was somehow done maliciously. But hiding or destroying documents is a crime. If there's a cover-up, I say get after it, Justice Department. What do you think, Ben?
If files were destroyed or hidden to protect the company or individuals, a much bigger restructuring is probably necessary and more people need to be held to account. Another news item that's important to note, Scott, the president's budget proposal includes a 15% increase in Federal Aviation Administration funding and plans to hire 2,000 air traffic controllers in 2025. That's not as big an increase as you might think. The Safety Review Team report issued in September that studied air traffic control problems said that the FAA's plan was for 1,500 hires in 2023 and 1,800 in 2024. The bottleneck, the report noted, is at the FAA Academy. Our friend David Grizzle, a former head of the Air Traffic Organization, who was part of the six-member Blue Ribbon team that conducted the safety review, has noted to us that the Academy doesn't have the technology, like simulators, to turn out enough controllers to really address the crisis.
And the Academy would seem like a quite fixable problem. It's a start, Ben. I'm glad the administration is recognizing that there's a big problem here that needs fixing. I still think we need a much bigger effort. Sure, a 15% budget increase, if it survives Congress, is better than the 4% we typically see. But it's not enough to solve the crisis. We need that Manhattan Project major effort to first figure out how to solve the problems, like the Academy bottleneck, short-term and long-term staffing needs, and equipment modernization, and then figure out how to pay for it. But a 15% budget increase is an interesting development. And one more development to note, Ben. Empty middle seats on Frontier Airlines. Oh, this story is so near and dear to my heart from my middle seat days at the Wall Street Journal. Frontier has started selling a middle seat block in the first two rows of its planes. Those rows also have extra legroom. It's called Upfront Plus. Prices start at $49. Presumably, both the aisle and window seat passenger would pay, and presumably most flights, it'll cost more than $49 to get that block. So Frontier could well see a decent fare for that middle seat through the Upfront Plus fees. On the other hand, as you've taught me, Ben, empty seats don't pay to check bags. Frontier doesn't have any first-class product, so this is Barry Biffle's version, I guess, of the big front seat you started at Spirit.
it's a good idea for them to test and doesn't require them to reconfigure their planes either. I'm sure they will watch this closely, not only as to the price, but whether the idea should be expanded or scrapped. For sure, they wouldn't be doing this if they were running 90-plus load factors.
It's very interesting. One of the most indelible lessons I learned early on about the airline business came from a travel researcher named Stanley Plogue, who was best known for developing psychological profiles of travelers. Spoiler alert, we apparently all fit into one of five categories. Stan's research found, and this was back in the 1990s when there was more legroom and more amenities like meals on board and all, that if the middle seat was empty, passengers reported the flight attendants were friendlier, the food tasted better, the flight was more on time. An empty middle seat was the strongest determiner of passenger satisfaction for a flight. It's a rarity now in this era of 93% load factors, but it sure makes the flight more comfortable. I say bravo, Barry. Airlines have experimented with paying to block the middle seat before. It's tough to manage, but I hope it works for you.
Something else that works is the support our sponsors give Airlines Confidential. We want to thank Pratt & Whitney. At Pratt & Whitney, the pursuit of more sustainable aviation is foundational. For decades, Pratt & Whitney has been at the forefront of revolutionary advancements in aircraft propulsion technology. And by working smarter, cleaner, and greener today, they are committed to supporting the aviation industry in its goal of reaching net zero CO2 emissions by 2050. Learn more about Pratt & Whitney's smarter technology, cleaner fuel, and greener business at prattwhitney.com.
We want to thank DoHop, which is revolutionizing travel connectivity. DoHop is a travel technology provider enabling airlines to expand their networks, offer more connectivity, create additional partnerships, and focus on improving the customer experience with more offer services and travel options. Airlines benefit from generating additional revenue, lower costs, and maintaining full customer ownership. Plus, in the event of travel disruptions, DoHop works with airlines and offers assistance in helping passengers reach their final destination. Visit DoHop.com. That's DoHop.com.
And we want to thank Cirium, which offers the most accurate and precise data and analytics to enable airlines to optimize planning, operations, and passenger services. The right intelligence drives operational efficiencies, enables you to predict market shifts, and help airlines respond quickly to maximize revenue, manage costs, and seize commercial opportunity. Visit Cirium.com for more.
Okay, time to bring in the legendary Rudy Maxa. Rudy Maxa is the face of travel for many Americans. He's a consumer travel expert and longtime host of the TV series Rudy Maxa's World on PBS. He is well known as the Savvy Traveler on public radio and co-hosts a weekly syndicated radio show. He's been a prolific travel writer for National Geographic Traveler and other publications. All that after 13 years at the Washington Post, where his political scandal coverage was nominated for a Pulitzer Prize, and 9 years as a writer for the City Magazine, Washingtonian. Rudy lives in St. Paul, Minnesota, and is really a citizen of the world, always going somewhere. It's a pleasure to catch up with you, Rudy, and great to have you on Airlines Confidential.
Well, thank you, Scott and Ben. It just sounds exhausting hearing that bio, but I am an old guy, so it's okay.
Okay. Well, part of that bio, you and I recently appeared together on a panel at a travel show in Atlanta where several people were asking a lot of questions about travel insurance. It struck me that post-pandemic, living in a turbulent world such as we are now, with all kinds of airline and airplane reliability issues, the travelers have a lot more anxiety about travel these days. Not that it's stopping them from traveling. What do you think the state of leisure travel is right now?
I think it's very robust. Certainly, as we're going into the summer, it will be. Although I would avoid Paris for the next couple of months, but because of the Olympics. But yes, I believe people are sometimes trepidatious, particularly first-time travelers, who, if a flight is canceled or it's overbooked, really don't know that they have any rights, don't know what their alternatives are. I think people are not familiar with travel insurance, and we can talk about that in the course of our interview today.
Rudy, as someone who has run a tour company and been a consumer advisor on travel for many years, what advice would you give to airlines? If you were the CEO, what changes would you make?
What advice would I give to airlines?
Yeah.
Well, gosh, that's a very difficult question because I've certainly never run an airline, but I certainly have a lot of thoughts. I know flight attendants are on airlines to provide emergency service if necessary. If someone has a medical emergency in flight, or if there are problems in the flight or tumult in the air and people are nervous, or God forbid, something even worse happens. But generally, they are equivalent to sort of hotel employees. They're service employees, and they are the face of the company. You know, you never see the CEO of a company on a plane. He or she's got a private plane. But so I would train my staff as if I were training them to be employees at a Four Seasons or a Ritz-Carlton. I will say that most of the flight attendants I come across are very charming and very helpful. But then every once in a while, you get a real stormtrooper who, don't look me in the eyes when I walk down the aisle kind of person. So I would, since flight attendants and gate agents and ticket counter agents are the face of the airline, I would really work on customer sensitivity and customer service. Obviously, given some of the news that Boeing has been in lately, particularly following the loss of that Alaska Airlines door, et cetera, and a tire blowout. I mean, Boeing's been really taking a shellacking in the press. Obviously, I would say to airline executives, be careful. I would say to Boeing, and I would certainly say to the National Transportation Board and the folks from the federal government, the FAA, who's supposed to be keeping an eye on airlines, to big up your game, in short.
And what's the most frequent question you get from travelers on your radio show and at your appearances?
I'm sure it's the one you get too, Scott, which is, where's your favorite place in the world? Well, let me do two of them. One is, where do I got to change my money before I go to Istanbul or Paris or Tokyo? And I tell them, relax. You don't need to change your money before you go. There are ATMs everywhere. If you can avoid it, don't use an ATM at an airport. Use an ATM that's connected to a bank downtown and wherever you're going, but you can get your local currency there. That's number two of the most frequently asked questions. The other one is, what's your favorite place? And here's the answer I've developed, and you guys are welcome to use it. I finally figured out it's someplace I discovered later in life. I'm an Army brat. My father was stationed twice in Germany. And every weekend we would get in the car and we would drive to Amsterdam, or we'd go to Brussels or to Geneva or to Paris, or fly over to England to see friends. We traveled all through Europe. So I was quite familiar with Europe. And then most of my life, adult life, I lived on the East Coast of the United States. Back when it was quite cheap to fly to Europe from the East Coast, particularly if you were a student, there were things called student fares. So Europe, I'm pretty familiar with compared to most Americans. I didn't get to Asia until I was, 32, 33, 34. I'm terrible on ages, years, but I was just gobsmacked by Asia. And so that's sort of my favorite region to go to now. I particularly like Thailand. I certainly like Hong Kong and Vietnam. But I think it's because I discovered it later in life. And I think if my dad had been stationed in Asia and we had traveled around Asia a bit, it's a little more difficult to travel around Asia than the countries in Europe, obviously. But if we had traveled around Asia and I didn't get to Paris or Venice or Rome or London or South of France or anywhere in Europe, I'd be similarly gobsmacked and as fascinated. So I think it's someplace you discover later in your life. Of course, your hometown is never your hero. I mean, I lived for decades in Washington, D.C., and did I ever go up the Washington Monument? No.
Yeah. Exactly.
Because it's down, it's boring. You want to go somewhere exciting like New York, or LA or San Francisco.
No, that's what tourists do.
Right. Exactly. So that's my answer. It's someplace you discover later in your life that surprises you and amazes you.
And if someone asks you for the one piece of advice you'd give, what's your best recommendation, particularly about air travel?
Well, these days, getting to the airport a little earlier than normal. I know everybody tells you to do that, and everybody tells me to do it, and I rarely do it. And even if you have pre-TSA, and even if you have a membership in Clear, there are very busy times at the airport. And if you fly a lot, you get to know them. Strangely enough, you might think, one of those 6 a.m. or 7 a.m. flights, there'll be nobody at the airport. Well, everybody's at the airport because that's when planes take off to begin their day. I mean, airplanes got to get in the sky for an airline to make money. So they don't wait around for you to wake up and mosey on in at 10 o'clock. Now, there may be very well be a 10 o'clock flight, but if you travel when people are getting off work and want to fly home from a destination or in the morning to get to a destination, the airport's going to be much more crowded than it is if you waltz in at 1:30 or 2 when planes are in the air. So it used to be 1 hour before domestic flights, 2 hours before international flights. That was sort of the rule of thumb. I try to get there at least an hour and a half, if not two, before domestic flights if it's a busy time, like in the morning, and more than 2 hours if it's an international flight, certainly if I'm not familiar with the airport. I mean, some airports are huge. You know, London Heathrow is enormous, and you can walk a quarter of a mile easily at an airport before you get to where you need to get. And if you're stuck at customs or immigration or...
Or Chick-fil-A or Starbucks.
Right, exactly. Yes.
And how do you think AI will impact the travel world? We have heard the impact of AI on this podcast. I think we see it in so many aspects of our life, but I know you've looked at this very closely. How is AI impacting travel?
I think it's been impacting travel before we knew it. I think airlines and, you know, with their reservation services and their websites have been using AI before you and I knew the phrase, although now AI is the phrase of the year. I mean, everything's artificial intelligence, NVIDIA, you know, Apple. Remember how much the smartphone affected us? I'm old enough and, you know, to remember when if I didn't know the way to something in the countryside of, say, France, you know, I'd have to try to find a phone, hope I have a coin that fits it, hope I know how to use the local payphones, hopefully call the hotel I'm going to get directions. So the smartphone really revolutionized how we travel. And I think AI will do it in a similar way. First of all, it'll tell your smartphone a lot more than it knows now. And I'm sure, like you guys, I get calls occasionally from people you don't know saying, you know, where's the best place to propose marriage to somebody romantically in France, or where should I eat here? And some of those questions we can answer, particularly if we're familiar with the destination. But I remember getting a call one day from somebody saying, no, it was an email from somebody I didn't know saying, you know, we're a family of two adults, mom and dad and three kids, ages 6 to 17. And we want to go to Europe this summer. We want to rent a car for 2 months and start in Scandinavia and drive southward all the way to the tip of Italy. What route should we take? Where should we stop? Where should we stay? Are there any particular restaurants you'd recommend along the way? And keeping in mind the ages of our children, what things should we stop and see and spend time on the way down to the boot of Italy for these kids? Well, I mean, that's an impossible. I mean, I could, you know, if somebody paid me, you know, $40,000, I would spend them, you know, 2 weeks figuring that out for them. But I had to say, look, I'm not a travel agent. And you're asking so many questions. You can do research online. You can use your phone. You can use your laptop, whatever. But AI will do that. And it'll also search fares. It'll give you more probably options than, say, going on Google Flights does now. With AI, it's going to be a geometric explosion of information for flights and alternatives. On our panel that we were on, Scott, remember Peter said he wanted to fly. Peter Greenberg, another travel journalist, a friend of ours, wanted to fly from LA to Honolulu. And he was seeing quotes of $700 or $800. And he called an airline and they said, because they had more information on their computer, she said, look, I'm going to save you a lot of money. Hop from LA on a short flight to Vegas and fly out of Vegas, and it's $300 or $400 round trip. We will have all that at our fingertips.
And so with all that information, does it mean we'll travel more?
Well, if we save money, we might have more money to travel more. Yeah. Traveling is certainly one factor in travel is the amount of time we have. And given that we have this vacation deficit disorder in America, where the average worker gets 2 to 3, maybe 4, if they're lucky, weeks a year to travel, no matter how cheap it is, I don't know how much more you can travel. But it will certainly make it easier to travel, yes, and maybe more efficient to travel and maybe cheaper to travel.
Yeah.
Rudy, years ago, my wife and I were in Bangkok. We had the Lonely Planet City Guide. We wanted to go to a small street called Monk's Bowl Village. We followed the paper map, making turns until we got to the street. When we turned in, a group of men smoking and playing cards looked up and said, "You want rice bowl? I'll miss those experiences."
Yeah, well, that's true. Lonely Planet guides were so popular. Yeah, that is That's a common problem. I mean, everybody wants to go see the Eiffel Tower. Everybody wants to go to that street in Bangkok. Here's what I do. All right, let me take different examples. If I want to have a special dinner in a city, a romantic dinner, just a special place, I'll go to a fancy an expensive hotel, even if I'm not staying there, which I'm sometimes not, and go to the concierge. Concierge will answer questions from any of them. They don't know if you're staying in the hotel or not. Just go up and ask. They will then tell you where they send most American tourists who stay in that hotel to dine. And after they finish that, I say, okay, now where do you take your husband or wife on your wedding anniversary or their birthday? And they go, oh, that. Oh, well. And then they give you the name of the restaurant you want to go to. So that's one technique I use for restaurants. These days, again, there's so much information on the web. You can type in the 20 best things to do in Bangkok. Or you go on Instagram and there are people in Bangkok telling you the 15 things you can't miss. And sometimes they're touristic places, and sometimes they're touristic places you wanted to. You know, you want to see the Emerald Buddha. You know, you probably want to go to, what's his name, Silk Shop. And you want to go along the canals called Klongs, the canals of Bangkok on a long-tail boat. So there's nothing wrong with going to popular places. But yeah, it is funny. I mean, it's just talking to locals, really. And speaking of that, by the way, there are any number of websites now that offer you dinner in real people's homes in real cities. And sometimes they'll ask you to bring a bottle of wine. They might ask you to pay them 20 euros or 15 euros. But the husband and wife make the dinner, and you might be there with another couple who's traveling as well. But you're in somebody's house, you're meeting a local, and you get to ask all those questions that you ask your traveling companion when you're walking through a new city. I wonder how much it costs to rent an apartment here. I wonder if they have to pay for public school here. I mean, how many weeks vacation do they get a year from their in their jobs? What's a house cost here? All these questions you ask yourself, you can do over the course of a dinner in a local family's home. So if you just say, you know, dinner in a local family's home in Amsterdam or Brussels or Hong Kong, you will find a place. And if you reach out to them and if they have room, they may invite you to dinner. It's basically being invited to a local's home for dinner. And I have done that several times and found it deeply satisfying.
We've talked a lot about how credit card rewards have really changed the finances of the airline industry. Looking at it from the consumer end, are co-branded credit cards and travel rewards cards helping travelers in meaningful ways?
I think if you understand the cards and you understand what your travel needs are and get a card that fits your travel needs, yes, I think it's very helpful. Yeah, you're absolutely right. You know, if airlines were not selling miles to credit card companies, they would be out of business. It's that simple. Credit card companies pay them tens of millions of dollars a year to buy miles, which they then give to us. Of course, we pay for them, you know, and the fee for the card and so on. The first thing is, if you live in a city with what we call a fortress hub, like where Delta is in Atlanta and Salt Lake City, and where I live here in Minneapolis, St. Paul, or Chicago, it's American and United. If you live in a town that is served majorly by one or two airlines, you might want to get their co-branded card because it'll give you a free check bag when you travel. I mean, that's basic. That's the most basic. And that could be expensive. You know, they're raising check bags from $25, $35 to $45, $50. And if it's a round trip, that's $100 per person right there, a family of four, an extra $400. So if you have a co-branded credit card with that airline, you can avoid that $400 in fees for a family of four. That's significant. Generally speaking, I call them third-party cards. I don't know if other people do, but they're cards issued by banks that don't have a connection to a particular hotel chain or a particular airline. And Chase, well, any number of companies put them out. Chase puts them out, and oh my gosh, Scott, you know them all too. I have them. I all have them all, but I have so many I can't remember.
Capital One, Citibank,
American Express.
Yeah,
exactly. And those cards, you accumulate miles or points on most of them. Many of them can be applied to several hotel chains, to rooms in several hotel chains, or flights on a number of airlines. So then you decide, if you need to fly a particular airline or stay in a particular hotel, whether you have miles or points on those third-party cards that you shift over, and it usually happens instantly, you just move those points over as many as you need into that particular frequent flyer account or hotel loyalty account, and boom, you're there. But you still retain your other miles, and you have more flexibility because you have more airlines to choose from, more hotels to choose from. So I'd have, if I have one airline to fly all the time, I would have a card issued by a bank in association with that airline. But otherwise, I'd use cards that accumulate points and miles that I can throw at anything.
Do you have any destinations that you haven't been yet that you're itching to go?
Well, yes. I've never been to Rio de Janeiro.
No.
I went to Portugal for 3 days once. This was just like just before COVID because I was so irritated. I'd sort of spent a lot of years in Europe growing up and traveling, but I'd never been to Portugal and it was driving me nuts. So I just went to, for a long weekend, 3 days, and walked around Lisbon. But I've never been out of Lisbon, so I want to spend, you know, go down to Porto and go into the countryside and go to the beaches. So Portugal is undiscovered for me, strange as it may sound. I haven't spent enough time in Asia. I hope to go to Saigon this spring because I haven't been there, and I have a friend who's now living there, so that's helpful. One country I tell people to go that they don't often think of is the country of Georgia, which used to be under Soviet domination. And I sort of thought when I got there, it'd be this gray, you know, 1950s city with grandma selling old toasters on blankets on the street. And on the contrary, all the cabs were Mercedes and the street boulevards were wide and beautiful. Some of the stands are interesting. Uzbekistan is a country I did a television show in, and I was astounded. And it was also one that had been under Soviet domination for years. All the Soviets did right there, as near as I can tell, is renovate all the temples. They're gorgeous, gorgeous work. Now, there's nothing religious going on inside. Sometimes there's a restaurant sign, a music store, but they're beautiful to look at. And it's interesting. The problem with Georgia for Americans, as I recall, and this was before COVID, there was only like one nonstop flight out of London a day. So the one time I went, I had to stay in Istanbul overnight. I would like to see more of Georgia. I went there in the winter and went outside of Tbilisi, only an hour and a half, to beautiful ski resorts and incredible mountains and snow. The other way is to the Black Sea beaches, which I have not been to. So that's a place I would like to go to as well. I haven't done enough Costa Rica. Oh, there's so many places, you guys. There's so many places and only so much time. And I'm only one guy, you know?
Yeah.
I'd love to ask you those same questions.
If you take, you will happily choose a coach seat.
I don't happily choose a coach seat, but I choose them a lot. I mean, I'm usually paying for my own travel, mostly. And sometimes I choose a coach seat. I try to avoid coach seats for flights to and from Asia. That's what I save my miles for. Occasionally Europe, my family, my two grandchildren live in England and in France. So those are my life. So I try to go there every couple of months. So I can't really afford or either in miles or cash business class tickets. But I'm a lead on Delta because Delta owns the city I fly in and out of, so I can sometimes use miles to upgrade. So no, I never happily fly coach. I don't know anybody who happily flies coach. But for, you know, if the flights, I mean, to LA from here is 2.5 hours, 3 hours, that's fine. I don't care. I can sit in coach, take a book, you know, watch a movie. You're there.
So there are dangerous places to travel, and then there are really dangerous places to travel. Name a few you would go to and a few that you would avoid.
I think I would go to Iran because I have some Persian friends. And in fact, I did an interview with a travel writer who lives in Japan, but he's American, though he's from India, and his name is Pico Iyer. And he did a book called In Search of Paradise, which I would certainly recommend. It's not your normal travel book about trying to find a sunny beach. It's a much more philosophical and almost religious book, although not religious per se. Anyway, he went to Cyprus, where there have been some problems, and he went to Iran and found it to be totally different than what he thought it would be. And he's a big world traveler. Hmm. So I would go to Iran. I've certainly been to Russia when they weren't our friend, but I don't think I would go now. I don't think I'm important enough to be kidnapped and held for ransom and have the Wall Street Journal make a big deal about, but I just don't want to go to Russia particularly now, though St. Petersburg is always a beautiful city. I never rush to Rio because I know petty crime and sometimes more serious crime is a problem there. I would like to go to the coasts of Brazil, not been to Brazil at all. Where else wouldn't I go? Obviously you're not going to go anywhere where there's open conflict. I mean, Taiwan would be fine. I mean, I have been to Taiwan. I like Taiwan a lot. There are places. I mean, Africa is having a whole lot of trouble, and so is Central America. I mean, the countries in Central America used to be, you know, fairly, you didn't really have to think about it. But except for Costa Rica, Central America, the governments are, you know, causing people to flee. We know that because all we hear about is the immigration the crisis on our border. And I would say most of those people are from Central America. Mm-hmm. So there are tumultuous times there. And, you know, and old hands who go there, I mean, if you go there a lot, fine. You know your way around, you know it. But, you know, I wouldn't rush off to most Central American countries right now.
How about Somalia or Haiti?
I mean, I'm interested in every place. So I would be interested in going to Somalia, but I'd want to talk to somebody who knows both those places much better before I go. Let's put it that way. Or have somebody when I get there who I know. It would be like the first time I went to I won some contest, a drawing to go to Tokyo when I was young. And I didn't speak Japanese. I didn't know anything about Tokyo. And I landed and I was totally confused because street signs aren't in English like they are in Hong Kong, for example. And I was totally confused. Not until later when I went with a Japanese friend did I get it. And how wonderful it is. And I would feel the same way about, say, landing in Somalia tomorrow. I'd go, okay, what do I do here? You know, where do I not go?
As a journalist, when you went from investigative reporting on politicians in Washington to writing about travel, were there any similarities? Or was it just stepping from one world into a completely different world?
Well, I didn't really step into it. I didn't plan it. It was just sheer serendipitous event. It was just chance. I mean, when I was a Washington reporter, I did 11 years at the Washington Post and 9 years Washingtonian or so. And I would occasionally write for the Washington Post travel section, pick up an extra couple $100 and have an excuse to go somewhere and to do something. Because I like when I get to a place, I have a reason to look for something. Like, you know, first time I went to Macau off Hong Kong. It was to find out where they made those little Hot Wheels that my son loved to play with. That's where they came from. So I was in search of the Hot Wheel factory. You know, I like to have a quest when I get there, so I have a focus for my trip, unless it's a leisure trip, obviously. So, you know, I started writing these travel pieces for the Post, maybe 3 or 4 a year. And then a business show called Marketplace, it's one of the big shows now on public radio, but was just starting, called me up and asked me to do political commentary. 2 minutes every 2 weeks for $75. And I said, I don't do political commentary. I cover politicians. I've sent some to jail. I've caused problems for some. But I don't do commentary. I don't say what I think about should be done on policy matters or anybody's policies. And they kept pestering me. And it was $75 every week. I wasn't a radio guy, really. And finally, I finally said, well, look, I travel all the time. And I'm always interesting to find well-dressed men and businessmen and women who look like they have a college education, shaking a ticket angrily at a ticket counter in the airport at a reservation agent. They're going, you know, why can't I change it from Cleveland to Cincinnati? They're both in Ohio. And I said, so I could do this. How about a little consumer travel commentary? And they said, well, we're a business show. And I said, well, travel is big business and business people travel. And they said, well, you know, send us 20 ideas. We'll never call you back. And I typed them up. We didn't have computers then. I typed them up. I put them in the U.S. mail. There was no email then. And they called up and they went, well, that's sort of interesting. How can you get upgraded to first class without a first class ticket? What do you do if you reserve a room and pay for it ahead of time? You get to the hotel at midnight and there are no more rooms because they sold it to someone else. What are your rights? And I said, well, it's going to cost you $75 every 2 weeks to find out. So my friend Peter Greenberg, who I mentioned before, was doing a column at the LA Times called The Savvy Traveler. And I said, could I use that name for radio? He said, sure. So this Savvy Traveler commentary, you know, I didn't even think about it. It was every 2 weeks. It was 2 minutes, $75. Wasn't a big part of my life. I did it for 3 or 4 years, and I was surprised that people in public places would start recognizing my voice. I would think, get a life. And then they called one day and said, hey, we got $1 million from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting for your new one-hour Savvy Traveler radio show on public radio. And I went, what? What do you mean, what one-hour show? Well, we didn't tell you we were applying for it because we didn't think we'd get the money. So I said, well, I'm a Washington writer. I don't do a one-hour travel show. I don't even know what public radio is. I didn't listen to it. I didn't have a car, so I just walked to work. I didn't hear it. I had to do it or they wouldn't get the money. So to make a long story short, I did that for several years, and it became popular, and more magazines started asking me to write for travel, like magazines like Worth and Forbes and USA Today, all kinds of places. And then television called, and, you know, I'm not particularly good looking. It's a good thing we're not doing this on video, but they wanted me to do this more upscale travel show than was on air at the time, more emphasis on food and wine and nice hotels and so on. So I've done 98 half hour of those called Rudy Max's World that are pretty much off public television now, but they're all available for free on Amazon Prime and other, you know. So I didn't ever really step into travel writing. I sort of fell into it.
Well, you handsome devil, thank you very much. You do look great on television. You do sound great on radio, and we are thrilled to have you on the podcast. Thanks very much, Rudy. It's been a delight.
Well, Scott, thank you. I spent years enjoying your writing in the Wall Street Journal. As you know, I tell you that every time I see you, and if I don't, I should. And Ben, nice to make your acquaintance on the radio and on audio, I should say. And thanks for having me on, you guys.
Thanks, Rudy.
Thanks, Ben. Take care.
We'll be back with more on Airlines Confidential in a minute.
Promotional consideration provided by TheAirchive.net, celebrating 20 years with a fresh new look and over 60,000 items of AvGeek goodness. It's the hub of air transport history, and you're welcome aboard. TheAirchive.net.
Thanks again to Rudy for sharing interesting insights into travel today.
Ben, I want to remind listeners that Airlines Confidential will be on stage for a keynote podcast at Aviation Festival Americas on May 15 in Miami Beach. This is the 16th year for Aviation Festival Americas, and it brings together more than 250 influential leaders from the U.S., Canada, and Latin America. If you'd like to attend, listeners can get a 50% discount by going to airlinesconfidential.com, clicking on the Aviation Festival banner ad, and using the promo code AC50. It's going to be a great event, and we're really looking forward to being part of it.
In the mailbag this week were many notes that warmed my heart and supported my decision to try the AI-generated voice. Let me say that I deeply appreciate all the support for the show and for me personally. One note that wasn't about my voice came from Paul from Bainbridge Island, Washington. Paul wrote, "I listen every week, but I was disappointed by the latest show where you spoke to Doug Parker. Sorry, but I found Doug Parker's claims totally disingenuous. Doug Parker owns a total of 2.5 million American Airlines shares, according to a 13F filing dated March 11, 2023. That represents 0.4% of the company's total shares outstanding. His statement that he has no link to AA is totally false and should have been disclosed. American has been the most ardent opponent to JSX, first taking their opposition to FAA, and when that wasn't fast enough with TSA."
Point well taken, Paul. We appreciate that. I'd add only that I do think the security concerns here are real and need to be addressed. There should be one level of security in commercial aviation, period. If something happens to a JSX plane in a terrorism incident, it's going to affect all commercial aviation. What people will know is an airliner had a terrorist episode. I don't think making JSX passengers pay the $11.20 Federal Aviation Security fee on each round-trip ticket and bringing TSA to the terminal JSX uses would kill JSX. Some passengers might even feel better about JSX and ride more often. But the main point is, this is a different level of security, and the TSA needs to evaluate it and take action if it thinks it should take action. Ben, the response to the new voice option was absolutely fabulous. Allow me to share a few. Listener John C. wrote, "Hey guys, love the podcast. Great no matter what. I don't mind the new Ben to the extent it reflects the real Ben's thoughts, as I know it does. But as I explained to my five-year-old recently when she asked about, and alas, yes, I make her overhear the podcast from time to time, I've found Ben's more recent, perhaps less smooth, non-AI voice refreshing and empowering for people with disabilities. And I say that as someone who has had trouble communicating his whole life and who wishes he was a better communicator. Anyway, I can live with either one, and Ben should do Ben, as I gather he always does. So whatever makes Ben feel better and more insightful, I'm all for it. I've learned so much from the show. Thank you, thank you. Thank you, John. That's a great way of looking at this tool. It lets Ben be Ben." Michael from Orlando wrote, "Ben's amazing use of AI to assist you with augmenting and enhancing your voice. I love it. Kudos. Your voice never bothered me before since I listened to the podcast on 2x speed. But it's great that you and your vocal cords get a little bit of a break. For April Fools, you should change your voice output to Scott's voice just for a little fun." That would be a bridge too far, Michael. But but I'm curious now what I sound like at twice the speed. It'll take more than AI to fix my voice at any speed. Jeff from Dallas sent this. Ben and Scott, I actually teared up upon listening to Ben NVO today on the podcast. I first met Ben ages ago in Miami at an airline ancillary revenue conference when Ben was still at Spirit and I was leading JetBlue's onboard product. Ben gave the spiel by holding up a can of Coke and asking how much people would pay for a can of Coke because that's the difference between the rest of the airlines and Spirit. Was quite the speech, and I was really honored to meet Ben after the speech at that event. I've loved listening to Ben over the years, and it's awful how ALS impacts its victims. The tears today were of joy. Joyful that the Ben I remember on that stage in Miami was back. Loving the new voice, and I'm happy to see AI having an extremely positive impact. Keep up the great work, guys. Thanks for the weekly podcast. John, Michael, Jeff, and all the many others who wrote, thank you, thank you. Thank you for listening. Thank you for caring. Thank you for your support. Ben, let me just add, you democratized flying and made it affordable to many who couldn't fly otherwise. And your unbundling at Spirit created a fee structure that saved airlines financially through oil spikes and other crises. Now you've given voice to a technology development that can literally change lives. Once again, you're blazing the trail. It's not a cure for ALS. That will be the most exciting development to celebrate when it comes. But it is a new solution to an old problem. We are very grateful for your courage, your conviction, your commitment to Airlines Confidential, and your hard work. Well, that's all for another episode of Airlines Confidential. Thanks again to Rudy Maxa, and thanks again to all of you.
Thanks for listening. Old voice and new voice. No more talk about that going forward. Hey, we'll just keep doing it. We'll be back next week with more on Airlines Confidential.
This podcast is produced by Mass Media. Info at massmedia.net.